Pentagon says an American warship and multiple commercial ships have come under attack in the Red Sea.
The attack potentially marks a major escalation in a series of maritime attacks in the Mideast linked to the Israel-Hamas war.
Plus, Israel says it is trying to minimize civilian casualties as it continues its military offensive in Gaza.
There's not too many modern militaries in advance of conducting operations that would actually do that. So they are making an effort.
Houthi fighters recruited to back up the Palestinian group Hamas in its conflict with Israel paraded through the streets of the Yemen capital. Today is Monday, December 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. The Pentagon says an American warship and multiple commercial ships have come under attack in the Red Sea. The ships were struck by ballistic missiles fired from Houthi-controlled Yemen. The U.S. military said that its warship, the USS Kearney, shot down three drones in self-defense during the hours-long assault. The Iranian-backed Houthi rebels claimed responsibility. Associated Press correspondent Charles Day Ledesma tells us more.
The attack potentially marks a major escalation in a series of maritime attacks in the Mideast linked to the Israel-Hamas war. The Pentagon has told the Associated Press we're aware of reports regarding attacks on the USS Kearney and commercial vessels and will provide information as it becomes available. The British military earlier said that there had been a suspected drone attack and explosions in the Red Sea, while the Pentagon's not identified where it believed the fire came from. However, Yemen's Houthi rebels have recently launched a series of attacks on vessels in the Red Sea. I'm Charles Ledesma.
Meanwhile, Houthi fighters recruited to back up the Palestinian group Hamas in its conflict with Israel paraded through the streets of the Yemeni capital Sana'a on Saturday before heading to the Gaza Strip. Here's a member of the group parading through the streets on his way to Gaza. He says these popular crowds are ready and prepared to support the Palestinian people at the first opportunity to confront the Zionist and American aggression against our people and our region. Israel and Hamas are not yet willing to return to the negotiating table to discuss a ceasefire, but Israel says it is trying to minimize civilian casualties as it continues its military offensive in Gaza. In an interview on NBC's Meet the Press, National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby comments on steps the Israeli military is taking to protect the civilian populations.
We saw them go in with less force when they went into the north. We're seeing them now conduct what we would call shaping operations in other places and making preparations. But they have actually given civilians in Gaza a list, a map, it's online, where a list of areas where they can go to be more safe. There's not too many modern militaries in advance of conducting operations that would actually do that. So they are making an effort.
VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias also has this report.
After Israel renewed bombardments in Gaza against Hamas targets, several Palestinian families gathered Sunday at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir el-Balah to mourn the latest victims of the military offensive. As many prayed for the dead and others continued to flee, the United States affirmed that Israel is heeding its calls to minimize civilian casualties. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby appeared on ABC's This Week program.
They published online a map of places where people could go to avoid combat. There's not a whole lot of modern militaries that would do that. I mean, to telegraph their punches in that way. So they are making an effort.
But Israel and Hamas are still reluctant to negotiate a new truce and the release of more hostages.
It fell apart because Hamas was unwilling and refused to come up with additional lists of women and children, which we know they are holding, and put them on the list so that Israel could evaluate that and we could get them exchanged.
A recently published report by the New York Times points to Israel knowing in advance and playing down Hamas's plan to carry out the October 7 terrorist incursion. The questions that the article raises, however, will need to be answered at a later time, Ron Dermer, Israel's Minister of Strategic Affairs, told ABC.
After the war, we're going to have a serious investigation. It's very important during a war to unite all the forces to achieve a common goal, which we all have, which is to dismantle Hamas's military capabilities, to end its political rule in Gaza, and to ensure that Gaza doesn't represent a threat to Israel, and also to return the hostages.
In Dermer's view, destroying Hamas will open the door to regional peace.
And in the context of that regional peace, we'll have to figure out how we can put ourselves on a path towards an ultimate political settlement with the Palestinians.
Meanwhile, he added, Israel agrees with the United States on the need to reduce civilian casualties in Gaza and to ramp up humanitarian assistance. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Talks between negotiators and Qatar broke down, allowing the last temporary ceasefire to lapse Friday, and Israel resumed its military activities. I spoke with VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein, who gives us an update on the Israel-Hamas war from Jerusalem.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, as soon as the ceasefire fell apart pretty early on Friday morning, everything just kind of went back to what it was. And in fact, Israel has launched a pretty heavy assault on southern Gaza. It's told residents of Khan Yunis, which is a fairly large city in southern Gaza, to evacuate. The issue is, where are they supposed to go to? You know, they already left northern Gaza to go to southern Gaza. And right now in southern Gaza, there's 85% of the entire population of the Gaza Strip. Israel also announced that since October 7th, it has carried out 10,000 airstrikes, and it has found shafts or openings to 800 tunnels in Gaza.
Linda, now that the ceasefire is over, what is the status of the hostages? Hamas is saying no more released hostages until there's another ceasefire.
Right. Well, I think Hamas was saying no more released hostages until the war is over. In other words, not even a sort of temporary ceasefire. And so there is a lot of concern in Israel. There are about 115 hostages still being held in Gaza. Over 100 were released during the ceasefire as part of this deal, as well as, 300 Palestinian prisoners. And, the hostages have been reunited with their families. And, especially for the children, it's been very, very emotional. And as time goes by, we're hearing pretty terrible stories of what the conditions, where they were, how they were being held in, and the conditions were pretty bad for most of them. But there's still, as I said, about 115, mostly young men, although not exclusively. There are still some women. There are a couple of children. There are quite a few older men. And so there's a lot of concern because negotiations to release them have now stopped completely. And it's possible that they could be killed in an Israeli airstrike, or Hamas could say they were killed in an Israeli airstrike. So I think for the families of those who haven't yet been released, it's a very difficult time.
I understand the U.S. is putting some pressure on Israel to protect civilians. And I understand that also at this point, that might be difficult for Israel to take such extraordinary, if not nearly impossible, efforts to do so, especially since it's been reported that Hamas is hiding out among the crowds of civilians.
Right. So during this ceasefire, apparently, the Hamas fighters who were left in the north have moved down to the south. I mean, Israel says it's killed 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 Hamas fighters. It's very hard to get exact numbers, but there are still believed to be at least 10,000 more fighters, if not more than that. And Israel has said that what it's going to do, it divided the Gaza Strip, the southern Gaza Strip, into lots of little tiny areas, and then it's going to notify civilians of which areas are being attacked. And as I said earlier, for example, it told civilians to leave Khan Yunis. But where they're supposed to go isn't clear, and how Israel's going to be able to protect these civilians is also not clear. There's kind of a sense in Israel that the clock is ticking on this war, and that within a few weeks, Israel is going to be forced to stop. And it says it doesn't want to do this until it's sure that Hamas can no longer present a military threat to Israel.
With the renewed effort from Israel and past incidents of violence outside of Israel and Gaza itself, like in the border of Lebanon.
There's definitely concern about this fighting spilling over. In terms of Israel and Lebanon, there's been pretty intense fighting between Israel and Hezbollah. Israeli communities near the border with Lebanon have been evacuated. So far, it seems that Hezbollah has not wanted to kind of go all out into a war with Israel. But there's definitely been fighting, and that border has been heating up the West Bank as well. And there is concern, for example, that missteps or a misfired missile that hits and kills a lot of civilians in one of these other places could expand the borders of the war. Israel would prefer to keep it focused on Gaza right now and not have to fight on more than one front. But Israeli officials say they're prepared to do whatever they need to do.
That was VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. We're also following these other stories from around the world. Indonesia's Merapi volcano in West Sumatra province erupted early Sunday, spewing volcanic ash as high as 3,000 meters in the air. According to the country's disaster management agency, BNPB, authorities said volcanic ash was dispersed at high intensity to nearby districts. France's interior minister says police arrested a 25-year-old Frenchman who targeted passersby in Paris, killing a German tourist with a knife and injuring two others. After his arrest, the man was said to have expressed anguish about Muslims dying noticeably in the Palestinian territories and claimed that France was an accomplice. Venezuelans voted in a referendum Sunday called by the government of Nicolas Maduro to claim sovereignty over a large swath of neighboring Guyana. The officials argue the oil and mineral-rich territory was stolen when the border was drawn more than a century ago. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Police said about 20,000 people protested in Brussels on Sunday to demand more action to fight global warming as delegates from nearly 200 countries meet in Dubai for the UN's COP28 climate conference. This is Robin Rolls, a climate activist who was at the protest.
My message to the leaders is don't only talk about fossil fuel extraction and carbon dioxide. Reducing that is very important, but that's only part of the question. We need to ask how many resources do we use as the world? How do we distribute them fairly, not only for fossil fuels, but also for metals and minerals?
In Dubai on Sunday, the COP28 summit focused on climate change, fueling more sickness and disease. In Dubai, Action Against Hunger, an international humanitarian aid agency, is hailing the fund agreement that will provide financial assistance to countries adversely affected by climate change. The accord, called the Loss and Damage Agreement, was reached at the ongoing UN Climate Summit, known as COP28. VOA's Peter Claudi spoke with Marie Kosker, an analyst on food systems and climate crisis for Action Against Hunger.
On the loss and damage fund that was operationalized yesterday. It was a very long-standing call and demand from the civil society, so we are really happy to see it becoming real, actually. It's a real moment for climate justice, and it's the first time that we have this reparation dimension in climate finance. Then we still have some reservations about how this fund will be organized. We believe the World Bank that is going to host the fund may not be the right institution for it, but this can evolve in the future. Obviously, there are also many challenges ahead. We still need to have more pledges coming in.
But Marie, a lot of pledges are made during such conferences or summits. However, deliverables are sometimes not forthcoming. What do you think is going to be different this time?
Well, we think it's going to be maybe quicker than usual. For example, the Green Climate Fund, it took years for it to become a reality. And this time, we think the urgency of the situation and the current situation would enable the fund to to become a reality quite quick. And also the difference and the thing that is very welcome is that there will be a possibility for directly affected communities to access the fund, which is unusual. Often with those big multilateral funds, it's only states or institutions that can access it. And this time, there will be a community access window, and this is really, really important.
One of the calls that Action Against Hunger is making is for the increased access to climate finance for the most vulnerable. Do you think this is even feasible?
So this is exactly what we are asking for, also for the rest of climate finance that exists. So first, this climate finance needs to be increased. It's insufficient, and the quality of the finance also needs to be improved. For example, very much finance is delivered through loans instead of grants, and this can worsen the debt crisis for some countries. Then we also hope to see a better distribution between the finance that goes to mitigation and what goes to adaptation. Adaptation is underfinanced right now when it should be 50-50. It should be 50% for mitigation and 50% for adaptation. It's very much important for the countries that are most impacted because adaptation is what they need. Adaptation finance is what they need to adapt their systems and to their agriculture, for example.
That was VOA's Peter Claudy speaking with Marie Cosquer from Action Against Hunger. Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. condemned the deadly bombing Sunday, blaming foreign terrorists as police and the military strengthened security in the country's south and around the capital, Manila. Reuters' Rachel Judah has more.
Several people have been killed in a bombing in a Catholic mass in the southern Philippines on Sunday. At least 50 others were injured in the explosion in the city of Marawi. These government photos shared online show the immediate aftermath of Sunday's attack, which took place in a university gym. Although there appears to be no damage to the building, burn marks can be seen in the center of the room. President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has condemned the incident as a heinous act perpetrated by foreign terrorists. At a press conference, Philippine defense officials vowed to find those responsible.
We shall leave no stone unturned in order to root out the perpetrators of this heinous crime. Let us remember that this was done in a religious occasion in Marawi. And the intent really to foment terrorist activity to foment confusion, chaos, is a prime indicia of a terrorist activity.
Defense Secretary Gilberto Teodoro further confirmed there were strong indications of a foreign element in the bombing, but refused to elaborate so as to not compromise the ongoing investigation. In 2017, the city of Marawi was besieged for 5 months by Islamist militants. During the battle between those fighters and Philippine forces, more than 1,000 people were killed, including civilians. Sunday morning's attack follows a series of military operations against local pro-Islamic state groups in the southern Philippines. Both the police and the military have strengthened security in the country's south and around the capital, Manila.
That was Reuters reporter Rachel Judah. U.S. funding for Ukraine may soon come to an end. A divided Congress has so far failed to approve a long-term budget for the United States government, let alone new money for aiding allies mired in foreign conflicts. The country's top defense official says that's a mistake. VOA's Araj Arabasadi has more.
Sunday in Kherson, Ukraine. Officials report one fatality and 7 injuries after Russian shelling in the region. Just days earlier in the Donetsk region, at least 10 injuries and 1 fatality in a 6-missile attack were reported. Ukraine's interior minister said Russian forces fired into the territory. Russia's invasion of Ukraine appears headed into a 3rd year. Ukraine's government continues pressing allies for financial and material support, but in the United States, that may soon come to an end. Congress has yet to appropriate a long-term measure to fund the federal government, instead passing a short-term measure called a continuing resolution lasting just into the new year. Top military brass say that jeopardizes national security while urging Congress to pass a full-year financial appropriation.
That's the single best thing that Congress can do to strengthen our national defense. You know, our competitors don't have to operate under continuing resolutions, and so doing so erodes both our security and our ability to compete. And I also urge you to pass our urgent supplemental budget request to help fund our national security needs, to stand by our partners in danger, and to invest in our defense industrial base.
Failure to pass a long-term spending plan may have serious implications for continued wartime support for both Ukraine and Israel, a fact not lost on Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. In a recent interview, Zelensky said Ukraine must not allow the world to forget that, like Israel, his country is fighting for its survival, and doing so before a winter phase of combat sets in. At the ongoing UN Climate Conference, or COP28, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the clear message from NATO allies was continued support for Ukraine.
So it will be a big tragedy for Ukrainians if President Putin wins, but it will be dangerous also for us, because it's the message that he and other authoritarian leaders then will get is that when they use military force, when they invade another country, when they violate international law, they get what they want.
The comment comes amid the extended detention of Russian-American reporter Alsu Kurmasheva. She is a Prague-based journalist working for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which, like Voice of America, receives its funding from the U.S. Congress. Russia has charged her with failing to register as a foreign agent, a throwback to Cold War-era espionage. Back in Ukraine's Zaporizhia region, police bring residents small stoves donated by the Netherlands. In a mostly elderly community that has refused to leave despite no electricity, gas, or water, these stoves could be the lifeline for cooking and warmth as another winter at war sets in. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
If there's one clear takeaway from this recent NATO foreign ministers meeting in Brussels, Belgium, it is that the alliance's support and commitment to Ukraine is enduring, said U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
Some are questioning whether the United States and other NATO allies should continue to stand with Ukraine as we enter the second winter of Putin's brutality. But the answer here today at NATO is clear and it's unwavering. We must and we will continue to support Ukraine. Ensuring that Russia's war of aggression remains a strategic failure is as vital today as when the Kremlin launched that war almost 2 years ago.
I heard no sense of fatigue or falling back. On the contrary, a determination to continue to press forward, said Secretary Blinken. And there's a good reason for that. I think every ally recognizes that this is a matter not only of doing the right thing, he added, it's a matter of self-interest, including for the United States.
If we allow a country like Russia to act with impunity, to redraw the borders of another by force, to try to determine and dictate the future of another country, if that happens with impunity, then it's open season. And any would-be aggressor anywhere is likely to draw lessons from that. That's why it's been so important to us, but also to every country around the table, to stand strongly with and for Ukraine.
More than 50 countries, including most NATO members, have committed to ensuring that Ukraine has what it needs to not only defend itself against ongoing Russian aggression, but to help enable it to retake territory that Russia seized from it, stressed Secretary Blinken.
There's also, and I think this is critically important, a commitment on the part of many countries to help Ukraine build a future force that can ensure deterrence and ensure defense against aggression going forward.
Russian leader Vladimir Putin believes that he can somehow outlast Ukraine, its people, and its supporters, said Secretary Blinken. The work of the NATO alliance, the work of the individual countries that are part of this alliance, as well as many other countries around the world to support Ukraine, to help it defend itself, as well as to set it up for the future. That's the single most effective way to disabuse Putin of this very wrong-headed notion.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.